Hello, and welcome to Sobercast, where we provide AA speaker meetings and workshops in podcast format. We're an ad-free podcast, and if you enjoy listening, please help us be self-supporting by visiting Sobercast.com, look for the donate link, and drop a dollar or two into our virtual basket. We hope you enjoy the podcast. Have a great day.
Hi, everyone. My name is George. I'm an alcoholic. Grateful to be here and to be sober. Thank you, Pixie, for inviting me. Thank you, Jack, for coordinating my trip. And thank you, Mark, for being a wonderful host. I've never had anyone do this for me before, but I got into his car, and there was music playing that sounded just like a friend of mine who's a musician. And I thought, how could he possibly have this guy's music? And I said, is that the radio or a CD? And he said, no, it's Spotify. I saw that you were at a concert for this guy the other night, so I thought you might enjoy listening to it. How thoughtful is that? I was just blown away. Anyway, so excited to see my friend Tammy. We got sober in the same home group, and I just love you so much, and our sponsors are best friends, so that makes us related in some way. I'm not sure which, but and then my friend Rebecca, who is such a magnificent example of this program. I don't know where you are, but I love you madly. It's so cool to have this small world of AA no matter where I go. You know, I wherever I go, here we are. You know, I see us everywhere. And it's such a blessing to have this fatal disease and one of the cures be to come together and, you know, share our stories, the things that I swore I'd never tell another human being. I come and I tell you from a podium. And what it does is it gets rid of the separateness I feel between me and you. And I always thought if you really knew who I was, it would only make that separateness grow. But what it does is it gets rid of it, and it sets me free. And hopefully it sets you free too, you know. I've been sober since February 1st, 1993. I just turned 24 years sober, and I got sober when I was 24, which makes me way older than I thought I would ever be. I realize that there are people here who are older than me, but this is the oldest I've ever been, and it is shocking. I was always the youngest of my friends. I started partying really young. I just never dreamed I would be this old. And so anyway, quality problem. I don't remember when I had my first drink, but alcohol was a part of my life even as a kid. I could drink out of the adults' drinks, and I found a picture of me drinking out of a beer stein when I was 11 months old. I know because there's a date on the picture. My dad was tipping the back of it up, and I'm like in some little walkie chair. And I thought, well, maybe that was my first drink. But for me, it felt like I kind of tapered on to alcohol. I always wanted to drink, and the older I got, the more I figured out how to get to a drink. By the time I was 11, I was arrested for drinking in public, so I know it was already a problem at that age. My dad died of cancer when I was 6, and I was raised by a single mom who worked 3 jobs to support us. She was angry and depressed most of the time. There were moments where she was super charismatic and loving and funny, but those were few and far between, and I never knew what I was going to get. Most of the time what I got was when she was at home, she was sitting in her reclining chair in front of the TV, which was her only relief. And when I would say something like, hello, she would say, not now, Georgie. Like she was just already at 10 at me just saying hello. And so I didn't like to say hello very often, and so I started hanging out with the older kids in the neighborhood, and they were more accepting of me. And, you know, I started running with the older kids and smoking with them and drinking with them and doing other things. Now, I heard somebody say this from a podium, and it just really hit home for me. My first higher power was your approval. I was desperate for it, desperate for it. I needed it like I needed air. I looked to you to fill me up, to tell me I was okay. I looked at my teachers at school like that. I looked for their approval. And if I saw even a hint of it not being there, then I had to sever myself from that person, from that relationship, from that class, whatever. You know, because I can read minds, so I know when you don't approve of me. But in elementary school, I'm about the height I am now. And so, you know, I was the tallest girl. I was always in the back row in all the school pictures with the big, tall dude. And the big tall dude and I got paired off throughout my elementary experience because we were the tallest, and I don't know why we have to be together all the time, but whatever. The kids at school came up with a nickname for me, and that was BFU, which stood for Big, Fat, and Ugly. And that was not what I was going for. And those nicknames kind of always stick with me. It's so funny. Last year we had a class reunion, and I talked my best friend Diana into going. And, you know, I'm 24 years, well, I was 23 years sober. You know, I've got my stuff together now. I feel pretty good. I can go to this thing, right? So we go, and, you know, I start feeling like that kid, and I start feeling really uncomfortable, and there was a Friday night thing, and then there was a Saturday thing, and we're at the Saturday thing, and I'm feeling less than and smaller, and then all of a sudden some girls started, okay, so I thought they would look more like me, like properly aged, but they were skinny, perfect, wearing the cutest outfits and high shoes that I can only wear laying down, if you know what I mean, and they looked really hot, and I'm thinking, oh my God, I'm just feeling awful, awful, awful. And then a few of them started doing cheers, and so that was uncomfortable. And then they were tittering, and I guess it was obvious on my face that I was feeling badly, and I kind of put my head down, and I was going into full self-pity. And Diana looked at me, my best friend since kindergarten, and she said, "You were too tall, and you had a bad haircut. But it's over now," which made me laugh, which is the greatest thing ever. And then we let ourselves off the hook, and we didn't go to the Saturday night thing because we realized we didn't hang out with these people anyway. It was like I just felt like it was something I had to do, and I'm glad I did it, but you guys are my people. But those old ideas really are hard to shake. And in junior high, the kids came up with a nickname for me based on the size of my lips, which I won't repeat tonight, but now people pay to have their lips done, so... But so I hated myself desperately, and so it was really important that you like me. You had to make up for how much I hated myself. And I had my first boyfriend at 10. He was 16 years old, which is just so creepy, I don't even know where to begin. But I always looked older than I was. I always felt older than I was. I feel like I was born singing the blues. Like from the youngest age, I had these huge emotions. And I just always felt like if I could be an adult, somehow I could understand what this madness was about. And I was always attracted to older people and hanging out with older people. And some might say I was looking for a father figure. But this isn't therapy. This is AA. So most of the guys I dated were very, very much older. And had that boyfriend, and then, like I said, I got arrested for drinking when I was 11. You know, from the gate, I drank like a pig. I drank to numb the feelings I was having. My home situation, you know, if you've ever been around somebody that you know doesn't like you, that's how I felt in my house, and constantly looking for people's approval and just feeling so raw all the time. And then when I drank, I didn't care, and I was a lot of fun. Sometimes. Other times I would just cry and cry and cry and cry. You just never knew what you were going to get. I like Old English 800 talls. I like 10 high whiskey with a red Marlboro red box back. I like whatever you got, the cheaper the better because I can get more. That's how I drank. And it's funny because even today, so one of my favorite shows, it's only in rerun now, is Sex and the City. And I still, from time to time, think, I bet I could drink like that. You know, it looks so good. You know, these drinks I've never had, a cosmopolitan or a flavored martini, and I think how lovely that would be to be out with the girls drinking out of a beautiful glass, laughing and talking about Mr. Big. But then I'm reminded that the way I drink is with a funnel and a hose. Like, this never happened. Never. I had to learn how to drink with a funnel and a hose, which is beer bonging, and it took a lot of projectile vomiting and a lot of friends that were unhappy, but I finally got up to 5, and these are things I was really proud of how much I could drink. I could outdrink all the guys, definitely the girls. Don't even worry about that. But I was proud of these things, and it's so strange, and at 12 years old, I lost my virginity to a guy who was 19 because I couldn't bear the thought of him not liking me. And I made choices like that over and over and over again until I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. I had a boyfriend when I was 12, and I was with him from the time I was 12 into my 20s. intermittently because I like to overlap, and I'll talk about that in a minute. But I ended up pregnant at 13 and terminating that pregnancy. And I drank and used over that for a long time. And it wasn't until I came to the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. And, you know, our book says we won't regret the past nor wish to shut the door on it. And that's been my experience. Even today, things stay in a place of regret until I can use that experience to help someone else or to change something I'm going through. But back then I was just collecting regret. And so, I had my first suicide attempt when I was 12, and I had my second when I was 13. I'm sure those things, make sense to what I was going through at those two ages. I had one more suicide attempt right before I got sober, but, so I hated myself. And all the while I'm going through this, you know, I'm drinking every day. I'm stealing booze from the local store, or my mom would buy it for me because my mom was exhausted. As I said, just from like, hello, she just threw up her hands and said, you're going to do whatever you're going to do, and I'd rather you do it at home. It's safer for you to do it here. If you're going to smoke, smoke here. If you're going to drink, drink here. And so I take things pretty literally, and that's what I did, and I turned my room into a party room. And my mom had a little shopping issue, so we didn't have very much money at all, but my mom sort of figured that if something were on sale and you didn't buy it, you were losing money. And and if you buy something and you get something free, you have to buy it even if you don't need it. And so she would come home with things like, I got you two cases of Meisterbrow because if you buy one, you get one free. Or I remember one night she came home with a bottle of tequila, and if you bought the tequila, you got the matching shot glasses. And she said, I got this for you and your friend Ellen. So when she comes over on Thursday night to watch The Facts of Life, you can drink it, which is just really weird. Because there's that sweet, innocent part of me that was still watching The Facts of Life, and my friend Ellen would come over on Thursday nights, and we'd usually drink 7 and 7, but we can drink tequila this night. And then we'd go find a party and do whatever. But that's kind of what my life was like back then. This is when alcohol was working for me. And back to the overlapping. So this started at very young age as well, which is when I'm in a relationship in the beginning, and some of you may relate to this, you have those wonderful butterflies of a new relationship. Like, everything's better. The sky's bluer. The song's my favorite. Everything just seems so much better. And then after you're in a relationship for a little while and those butterflies start dying down, in a mature relationship, a long-lasting love replaces those butterflies. But for me, what happened is when the butterflies were gone, I blamed you because you put them there. And if I'm not feeling them anymore, it's because you're not doing whatever you used to do to make me feel that way. And if you loved me, you would. In fact, if you loved me, you'd do about 10,000 things you're not doing right now. So then I'd find somebody who would give me those butterflies. And then I would start cheating on you. And then you would dump me. And then I would go to the next person, you know, just such a victim, because I just want to be loved. That's all. And so I overlapped and overlapped and overlapped. And so that got really messy the longer that went on. And all the while, you know, I'm drinking like a pig. And I identify as an alcoholic, and I believe that my alcoholism gets me wherever I'm weak. So that can be food, sex, money, drugs, whatever. My alcoholism is always looking for a breach in security, you know, so I have to work a diligent program. Like those snacks earlier, I'm thinking, oh, there's a brownie. I want a brownie. I'll have a brownie. No, you'll have six. Ah! So I had nothing. No, thank you. But back then I just said yes to everything. So I went through all sorts of different phases with drugs. And when it got out of control, I could always stop because alcohol was there. But each time I started over again, got harder and harder. And alcohol impacted every relationship I had in my life. Even though I said I'm only hurting myself, I hurt every person that I interacted with by my behavior, by my actions, I mean, by my words. You know, everything I did affected my life in that way, and I couldn't see it, but it affected everything, and I didn't care because it was the only thing that gave me any relief was drinking, and there was no way I would give that up, and there's no way I'd go to an event where I couldn't drink. I wouldn't even go, and I wouldn't have one beer. Why would you have one beer? I don't even understand. If there's one in the fridge, why would you have it? I need more to even begin. So life was difficult, and my relationship with my mom was very difficult because I loved her and hated her and felt fierce loyalty to her and responsible for her. I have a mom and a grandma, and that was my whole family, and I was raised believing that there's only the three of us. We have to rely on each other. We can only trust each other. You can't trust anyone. Everyone will hurt you. You'll eventually have to get a job and you'll hate it. We all do. And, you know, like, this is like, you need a drink too, my God. And what happened is my mom moved away when I was 17, claimed bankruptcy, wanted to make sure I was going to make it through high school, which I did. As from going to summer school and going to continuation, I was able to graduate, and my mom claimed bankruptcy, moved home to my grandma, who I believe is the meanest human being who ever lived. And so I'm like, great, you know, they're all in cuckoo town together, all confined, that's great. But my grandma used to drink a lot, and she would say, you know, I'm not an alcoholic, I'm just a drunk. And now I know those two words are the same thing, but I would go, oh, okay, yeah, that's different. But she was more or less drunk all the time, and she used to tell me that if my dad were alive, how disappointed he'd be in me and how I'd ruined my mom's life, and that she was as miserable as she was because of me. And then she would tell me that she, too, was going to be dying very soon. And I found out later that she started telling my mom that when my mom was 9 years old, and she had my mom when she was 18. And so that means my grandma started dying at 27, and and she didn't actually die till she was 90. I believe it's the longest death on record. But any weekend, any summer vacation, any long time that my mom had off of work, we'd have to go spend with my grandma. So I was really happy that they were living together. And I somehow was able to take care of myself through these years, drinking and running my life into the ground and starting over and drinking and running my life into the ground and starting over and overlapping and overlapping and overlapping. And what happened was I had one last suicide attempt. I had my stomach pumped, and I was in a bad place, and it was the guy I was with, the married boss who had left his wife and four children for me, wasn't giving me the butterflies anymore. And my roommate at the time said, my brother has a little problem with crack cocaine, and his wife kicked him out. Is it okay if he comes and stays with us? And I said, sure, you know. Apparently he hadn't been to a program or anything. He was just better. It was magic. And so he came to live with us, and the thing I liked most about him is he was crazy about me, and it didn't matter how I felt about him at all, because I just needed that. I needed that acceptance. I needed that. And so I don't know about you, but it's really hard for me to be with somebody who has a different buzz going. You know, like my friends when I was a teenager, they'd be getting stoned, and they'd be acting so stupid. I'd be like, you're so stupid. Give me some. You know, then I'd be stupid too. And, you know, I remember going to parties, too, and you'd see, like, three or four people go off into the bathroom together, and you're like, what? Five people? What? And then they come out, and they're like, ha, 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 and you're like, you know what they were doing in there, you know, and it's super creepy until you're invited to go into the bathroom with the next group, and then you come out, and you're like, ha, 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 where's the keg, you know? So that's kind of what it was like with him. He was acting really strange, and I said, I want some. And within 6 months of doing that with him, I lost everything. I got evicted from where I lived. I got fired from my job. And he sold my car for a piece of crack cocaine, which went for about $20. And I had no place to go except for my friend Diana. Diana and I grew up together in La Crescenta, where I live again now, and her parents still live there. She had moved to San Diego and was living a big life. And I had stayed in our hometown just circling the drain. And when I had no place to go, her parents took me in. They were what I thought was a normal family. They sat down and ate dinner together every night. They talked about stuff at the dinner table. I was invited to that table several times and got to see what a family looks like, you know. And so when I didn't have a place to go, they took me in. And I lived in their basement for about a year before I got sober. And that year, I tried white-knuckling it because I had been to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous with my friends who really needed it, because I'm a good friend. But I knew it wasn't for me. I wasn't raised with any kind of religion, so I knew I couldn't do the whole God thing. And then I thought I wasn't bad enough. Then I thought I was too bad. You know, I kept finding reasons why not. And honestly, I had gone to one meeting, where this happened. So believe me, I get that this is my perception or where I was coming from at that time. But I remember a guy getting up to the podium and he was just like, today is the worst day. I went to work. Traffic sucked. Everything sucks, but I'm still sober. Yeah. And I remember thinking, oh, no, 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 no. Clearly I'm not that bad. But what I've come to find out is there's a bottom below, the bottom you know. And I'm the kind of gal who hits ground and keeps digging. You know, I grab a shovel. I'm like, we're not at the bottom yet. Oh, no, no. And so that's what that last year was about. But it was about hitting a bottom really spiritually. And so I was trying to not drink, and then I would drink and not drink and drink, and it's just a lot of work. And one day I just thought, if I'm going to be miserable, I'd rather be drunk and miserable than sober and miserable. And I poured my first guilt-free drink. It was white Zin in the box. And I was drinking that, and the phone rang, and it was a guy named Jeff, and he was working with Diana in San Diego, and she'd been telling him about her loser friend, me, because he had a cup on his desk with an 8 on it. And she asked him what it meant, and it turned out he was sober 8 years. And so he called me, and he said, I understand you have a problem with alcohol. And I said, I do. And he said, I want to give you the number of a woman to call in AA. And he gave me the number of Pat Y. And I called Pat, and she said, my husband Vince and I are going to a meeting tonight. Why don't you come with us? And it gives me goosebumps every time I share this, because a stranger called me, gave me the number of another stranger who took me to a room full of strangers, and I've been sober ever since. And that's insane to me. When I try and think about, you know, what is God's grace, that's what I think about. I think about that moment, you know, that's the epitome of it. That's the picture. And I went to that meeting with she and Vince. I drove to a stranger's house and got into their car and drove across town to the big Pacific Group meeting, which is kind of like this, you know, the lights on in everybody's eyes and they're happy and sober at the same time, which I was like, happy and sober at the same time. What? This is crazy. And I was interested, you know, I wanted to find out what was going on. And so Pat said she'd be my sponsor until I found one. And I took her literally and started looking for someone. But in the meantime, she gave me a really simple plan, which is going to regular meetings on regular days. Then she said, now get a commitment at each of those meetings. And I was calling her every day, just super simple stuff. Now, I had had no structure in my life at all, ever, never, never, ever. But what I thought structure was the man trying to keep you down. People over 30 who don't understand. That's not freedom, you know? But what I've come to find out is that the more structure I have in my life, the safer I feel, the more creative I am, the more time seems to bend, the more I commit myself to Alcoholics Anonymous, the more time I have for everything else. I don't know how. It's magic. Real magic. But it's like so many other things I've learned in Alcoholics Anonymous, so contrary to what I believe. So just having a little bit of structure in my life started getting good pretty quickly. I was one of those annoying newcomers who was really happy for 6 years. I remember people would say, well, you're just in that pink cloud. That'll pass. I'm like, why would you even say that to me? That's going to pass. Your happiness is going to pass and you're going to hell. No, but they didn't say that last part. But what I found out is I can be in that pink cloud, so to speak, if I just do the things I'm asked to do here. Go to meetings, work with a sponsor, do the steps, read the book, pray and meditate. You know, all of the stuff that we're taught to do here. If I just focus on those things, which I translate as working on my spiritual condition, work problems seem to resolve. Friendship problems seem to resolve. You know, everything else seems to resolve. Health problems, maybe not so much, but I'm in a better spiritual place to deal with them. So I'm happy, I'm doing all this stuff, and a family friend comes forward. I was about 2 weeks sober and told me all these secrets that my mom had kept from me. And I always knew that there was something weird between my mom and grandma. They seemed to be fiercely dependent upon each other, but they also would wound each other. Their words wounded each other. They would be in the same room, but they'd each be turning away from each other because they've said something that's hurt them, but yet they had to be together all the time. And so there was something that bonded them, and I didn't know what it was, and they were both really miserable. And so this family friend came forward and told me some things that helped make that make sense. But what I did is I wrote all those secrets down. Because when I confront you to tell you how you screwed me over, I like to be detailed. And so my plan was to take all this information and throw it in my mom's face. Because, I mean, isn't that the right thing to do? That's integrity, right? Telling people what you really think. That's what I thought it was. But instead, I took it to Pat. And I said, look at what I found out. And she said, it's so good that you have that written down. Because you're going to need that later. And I didn't know what she meant. And she said, I want you to work on being a good daughter and granddaughter. And I was like, I don't even know what that means. For real. I don't have any examples of that. I don't know what that means. And so we came up with a formula, and that was that I would call once a week, I'd write once a week, and I'd visit as often as I could. If I were doing those things, I would know at the end of the day when my head hit the pillow that I had been a good daughter and granddaughter. And maybe, just maybe, I could stay sober. It wasn't about trying to make them happy or make them better. It was about me staying sober. And so I did not tell them that I was going to do that, because I was always telling you what I was going to do. I'll call you next week. I'll see you tomorrow. I'll finish school. I won't cheat anymore. I won't lie. I won't drink. You know, none of it was true. And so I started to really see how my actions speak louder than my words. So I started sending the cards, and it was awkward at first. I had to get cards that already said something, and I'd write, "Love, Georgia." And I'd make the weekly call, and I'd have some kind of topic like, "Whew, the forecaster says the weather's looking bad in your area, ha ha," or, you know, oh, so awkward. Because when I first started calling, the only time I ever called them before is when everything was really bad. Like, I have no place to live. I have no money. I don't know what I'm going to do. Talk to you later. And then I wouldn't call for months. So every time I called, they thought, you know, "We thought you were dead." And it's like, no, just checking in. So I started doing that awkward. But it started getting easier, and then I started getting a bit grandiose, as I do, and I started thinking about how they must want to hear about my life. And so I started writing these long letters and these cards about my adventures and my newfound sobriety, and I was thinking that they're probably savoring each of these cards, maybe in a beautiful box. Maybe they're tying them with a ribbon. And I made my weekly call one week, really months into this excursion, and my mom said, "Well, we got your card, but Grandma's been having to white them out to reuse them, and we're wondering if you could start writing them in pencil." I actually just ran across a card, because I save stuff like that, ran across a card where my grandma had erased my writing to send me a card. What she used to do is just cut out the bottom, but anyway, So I did that. I started writing those cards in pencil, and I want to tell you why. Because I now had a sponsor who had said I could take all my problems to her and I would never have to do anything alone ever again. I was starting to have an experience of a higher power by going through the steps with a sponsor. And I was now packing more tools than I even knew existed on the planet. Like, I had a hefty tool belt. And it's not fair, but he with the most tools has the most responsibility. And in this case, it was me, and if they wanted the cards and pencil, so be it. It took me years to screw up the relationship with them, and it would take years for me to clean up my side of the street. And this was a really valuable lesson in learning about the dirtier your side of the street is, the cleaner mine needs to be. I am only responsible for my side of the street. If I just spend my time and energy over here, everything else seems to work out. The only power I have any access to is on my side of the street. Now, I've been over to your side of the street, and I've fiddled about trying to plug in. It's not there, and I've tried. Don't do it. But so I'm writing the cards in pencil, making the calls, you know, getting really active in my group. We do all sorts of extracurricular stuff, and I did everything. I didn't sleep for like a year, and I'd been given direction to take all the time and energy I'd want to put into going into school, put that into getting your steps done, all the time and energy you'd want to put into a relationship, put that into AA, get a little job to go to in between meetings, don't quit smoking, no major changes in your first year, and no relationships. And I was like, what? Because I've been in relationships since I was 10. So I'm like, I don't even know what you're talking about. But I had decided that I would do everything I was asked to do for that first year. I kept hearing, get a first year foundation, because that's what you're going to build the rest of your sobriety on. So I thought, I'll do everything I'm asked, and then when it doesn't work, I can go back to my glamorous life. And luckily, I haven't had to do that. So I followed that direction, and I made it to my year. And in our group, we have a watch. So let's say I was turning one tomorrow. After this meeting, we'd all head over to a coffee shop, and we'd all hang out until midnight. And then 10 seconds to midnight, everybody gathers around your table, and they go, 10, 9, 8, and then it 0. You know, they sing happy birthday, and it's maybe doesn't translate that well here, but to have a watch, you have to go to all the watches. So I'd been up really late, lots of nights, so I'm having a watch. And there were like 200 people at my watch. And as they're leaving, they shake your hand. And I knew everybody's name except for one person. And I couldn't believe how much my life had changed in such a short period of time. And I had stayed out of a relationship for that first year and an hour and a half because at about 1:30, I consummated a relationship with my new fella. And then 10 days later, we got engaged. And then 6 months later, we got married. And I was married to him my first 5 years of sobriety. And it did not last. Surprise. But not because of him. He is a really good guy, and we're both still in the same home group. But we always put AA first. We always stayed really close with our sponsors. That was always our first priority. We knew that going in, that was not non-negotiable. But when we split up, you know, it hurt. And we were going to a lot of the same meetings, well, like all the same meetings. And so I talked to my sponsor. Now, let me say this about that. So I've had four sponsors. The one I have now, I've had for the last 22 years. And let me say that I have never had a sponsor give me bad direction. I have had just exactly the right people in my life at the right time, but I have one now that, you know, I've had for 22 years. And I like to share this just because it's helped me so much. When you're thinking about changing a sponsor, or if you have the right sponsor, there are two questions that will let you know if you're with the right person. And that is, one, do you want what they have? Not on the outside, what they have, you know? Do you want what they have, and do you trust their judgment? And if you can answer yes to those two questions, you're with the right person. You don't have to worry if you're having doubt or whatever. I've had that twice with Marilyn, where I thought, well, maybe it's time I change. But I could always answer yes to those two questions. So anyway, I go to Marilyn, she actually wasn't my sponsor at that time. But I went to my sponsor at the time, and I said, you know, it was Marilyn, sorry. It's like, was it Monday, was it Tuesday? Who cares? Marilyn was my sponsor. So I went to Marilyn, and I said, you know, I want to go to some different meetings just for a while because it hurts. And she said, no, you know, you show up at your regular meetings, you walk through things with grace and dignity, and you're not to seek him out or to avoid him. And if you run into him, no questions. Just statements. So I learned to do something like this. It's good to see you. Have a great meeting. And let me just say that I got sober at 24, and I've been in the same home group all this time. So I've said, it's good to see you. Have a great meeting a great many times. After we split up, I got involved with someone else right away. I know, it's just, you never see it coming. And I thought that this guy was the guy. And so I'm super active in my group. I do everything. My life is at a full velocity from morning until night, working, going to meetings, taking classes, working with new people, giving people rides, taking people meetings. Woo! High activity. And then I had to have a spinal fusion. I'd had minor back surgery early in sobriety, but I had to have this major surgery. And I was looking at a 6-month recovery time if everything went well. And it didn't. I was like in that 1%, and I ended up being bedridden for about a year. And what happened for me is that everything changed, because I had learned to get my value to fill up that emptiness. I had learned that the only way to fill that emptiness is by giving. So it's like, there was a movie with Rock Hudson called The Magnificent Obsession, and he's like this playboy who's just like, you know, living this really shallow life, and then he discovers that the secret is service, and it becomes his magnificent obsession, and that's sort of what I've learned in Alcoholics Anonymous. And so now suddenly my life comes to a screeching halt, and I have to have babysitters, and I have to have people taking care of me. I was diagnosed with something called reflex sympathetic dystrophy, which is, it can be caused by any kind of trauma or injury, so the doctors thought it was the trauma of the surgery. And at first they thought maybe I had a blood clot or something, but the doctor that I was seeing had somebody before me that he couldn't diagnose for like a year, and he knew exactly when I presented, he knew what it was and sent me to a guy who was doing all this cutting-edge stuff with it. This is a disease that's been around since the Civil War, but it's one of those things like you don't know anything about it till you get it. And so I was going to the hospital 3 times a week to get cervical and lumbar punctures, like when they go and do epidural blocks. I was getting those. I was getting nerves frozen and all these kind of freakish things. And it was my home group that took me to those appointments, that brought me meetings, that prayed for me. I had people babysitting me every night. I had people taking care of me that I honestly wouldn't have had a cup of coffee with otherwise. And I look back at these seemingly difficult times, and they turn out to be some of the greatest times of my life. Like, what a sweet time when I think about that. Getting to know people that I wouldn't have gotten to know otherwise, and connecting with people at this really raw level that's just not available when your life is so busy and, you know, everything's moving so quickly. And I had to learn a new way to work my program. And I had to learn that allowing people to help me was a way of being of service too, because how much joy I got out of that, I had to allow somebody else to do that. And I had to be vulnerable, and I had to, you know, just suck it up. And so I'm doing all this stuff. My mom and grandma could not be there for me. They both possessed vehicles and had time, and lived about 230 miles away. But for whatever reason, they could not be there. And this has been my experience, is that sometimes when I'm going through something, the people that I think should be there can't be there for whatever reason. It's not even personal. But the people that I need, the people that are put in my path, are just the people that need to be there. And God has always put just those people in my path. So this guy that I'm seeing, you know, it's getting a little weird because I'm so sick and going to the hospital all the time. And so he came over one day and he said he'd consider a relationship and a commitment with me when I was well, and he dumped me. And I was devastated. So I called Marilyn, my understanding sweet sponsor. And at the time she was learning to play guitar. So oftentimes I'd hear her plucking away in the background. And I said, you know, I had been calling her with all the different installations of my pain, you know, the surgery, complications, can't drive anymore, lost my car, can't work anymore, don't have any money. Oh, my God, and now I got dumped. And she said, oh, this sounds like a wonderful country western song. And she started playing a country chord progression and sang my blues. And it made me laugh. And that's been one of the greatest things of my sobriety, is finding humor in everything. Really everything. And luckily, Marilyn finds a great deal of humor in my most difficult times. But so he dumped me, and I was just feeling so useless and full of self-pity. And, you know, I can pray for a character defect to be removed, but what normally happens is an assignment appears. And in this case, it appeared in the shape and form of a man named Mike Finch. And he was a man who was a member of my home group, and he had Lou Gehrig's disease. And I watched him go from walking and talking to being paralyzed from the neck down, and but never saw his joy dissipate. He loved AA. He used to say the only cure for ALS is AA. And he sponsored tons of people, and he was such an attraction of this program. And he and I became friends, and then we became more than friends. And I was able to spend the last 6 months of his life with him. And what a great blessing that was for me. And I think about Julie, who we were talking about earlier, a member of my home group who lost her son, and she was so, so sad, and people wanted her to get help and whatever. And she was like, no, I want to feel every feeling that is associated with this glorious boy that I loved. And I think about that because I got to feel it all. You know, going through that with Mike was so much fun, because he was like the make-a-wish boy. You know, like if you know you're going to die, you live a different way. You know, if you know you're going to die soon. And it was terrifying, and it was so, so sad, but I felt it all. And I think we alcoholics, I'll speak for myself, as an alcoholic, just as me, I'm afraid of my feelings. And so I don't leap when there are opportunities like this normally, but I could leap into this love with him because I had my sponsor, because I had this incredible home group, because I had this incredible support system. And so in falling in love with him, I found something redeemable in me too, because I didn't know I could love somebody that way and take care of him in that way. And so there was an experience, you know, there's a lot of things in my life that I thought don't have to do with Alcoholics Anonymous. But Alcoholics Anonymous is not about not drinking, it's about how to live. And so when I was 6, my dad had stomach cancer, and they had done a guinea pig operation where they left this hole in his stomach and he would have to be reclined. and stuff would bubble out sometimes and burn his skin. I mean, it was really graphic. And as a little girl, my mom tried to protect me from that, and she would put tubes in his stomach and do stuff. And one day I said, can I help? Because I was daddy's little girl, and I was holding onto that tube, and I let go, and it sprayed everywhere. And it was one of those memories that would pop into my head when I was just walking down the street, you know, and I'd be like, no. So flash forward, I'm with Mike, and he gets a feeding tube, and he says, I want Georgia to feed me. I'm like, no. And I said, you have to tell me if it sprays everywhere that that'll be okay. And he goes, no, that would be really bad. And then I explained to him what had happened with my dad, and he said, no, you know, it'll be okay. Let's just try. And I got to walk through that and kind of right this huge wrong that had always just hurt my heart, you know? And I got to do that with him. And of course, I became the number one feeder and medicine giver. No, I've got this. My job. And another thing, you know, when you're in an uncomfortable position, I have always been told, you know, if you're at a party and you're feeling uncomfortable, whatever, do something, get a commitment, assign yourself a commitment, you know, like go pick up dishes, go help, whatever. So in this case, there were lots of people coming and going from the house, saying goodbye and coming to visit with him. And I'd read about Death and Dying by Elizabeth Kubler-Ross. And she had talked about doing photojournaling. And so I asked Mike if I could do that for him. And so he said, yes. So for the last 6 months of his life, I took pictures of everything. Good, bad, ugly, trips to the hospital, pictures in the ambulance, getting his feeding tube changed, people coming to say goodbye, his dad kneeling at his bed. My most favorite picture, though, is, I can't really show it to anyone, but so he's on the commode, which he had to be put there. I was always on duty and then a lifter, but I couldn't lift him. So somebody else lifted him, got him into place. And one of his sponsees is sitting on the bathtub side right in front of him, just going, ah, me, problem, 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 while he's trying to do his business. And then there's another one of his sponsees who's sitting on the sink playing guitar in his own world, just like, and it's the single greatest picture I possess. And I was able to be there when he died. And that was such a great blessing. It doesn't always happen that way. But I was holding one of his hands and his dad was holding the other. And I feel so grateful for that experience. And I'm still close with his family and all those people who helped to take care of him. And about my health, so I was still suffering with chronic pain and stuff, and I was still seeing doctors, but I was getting better because I'd had this aggressive treatment. And I still suffer with chronic pain today, and what I want to say about that is we're not supposed to say our case is different, but if you suffer with chronic pain, I want to tell you your case is different, but not in the way you may think, or the way that I've learned is it means I have to do twice as much to feel half as good. And for me, I treat my pain with lots of AA, and Pilates. I'm sure other people have suggestions, but I'm good. Thank you. So about a month before Mike passed away, my grandma died. By the time my grandma had died, she had become the sweetest grandma. I don't know when it changed, but just like my disease rippled into the lives of the people I loved, I think my recovery did too. And somehow one day she changed to being like, you know how much your grandma loves you. You're such a good girl, you know? And I'm like, what? But I wanted her to see the new me. And, I wanted people to accept this new me, and I had to do the same. And so by the time she died, I had been a good granddaughter and I loved her, and I was able to be there for my mom emotionally. I was still living in San Diego where I had moved down there to be with Mike, and, I moved back to LA. I wasn't sure what I was going to do. I was, you know, you think I would come out of this really spiritual experience, you know, just doing great, but I wasn't. I wasn't willing to do all the stuff I was willing to do when I was new. And so I suffered for a long time, and I moved back to LA, and I was trying to get back in my home group, but everybody's life went on without me. I mean, how rude. And so it was about that time my mom said, now let me just say too about my mom and grandma, I forgot to mention this earlier, that they did not believe that they should ever have to call me. I called, I wrote, I visited. To the degree that this is a real phone call. My mom said, well, we wanted to wish you a happy birthday, but you didn't call. And so I learned that on my birthday, that I could all day long say, I know they're not going to call. I know they're not going to call. And then at the end of the day say, I knew it. Or on my birthday, I could wake up and I could call them and say, today's my birthday and I just want to say, I love you. Done. Enjoy the rest of your day. Seriously, these kind of thoughts never occurred to me before. I'll tell you something else. Sharon Crane talked about hearing a sad song on the radio and changing the station. Okay. This never occurred to me. In fact, if I heard a sad song on the radio, you know, I'd lean in, I'd turn it up. Maybe pull the rearview mirror back and see how I look. And then if a happy song followed, I'd hurry and find another sad song so I could keep going. You know, so many things I learned in Alcoholics Anonymous were so freaking simple. Like, I could not listen to Lynyrd Skynyrd till I was over 10 years sober. And it wasn't because it made me feel like I had to drink. It gave me an icky, gross, I don't even know what it's about, some feeling in my gut. And it didn't serve me to, like, keep doing that. Just one day I turned on Lynyrd Skynyrd and I went, cool, Southern Rock, and it was over. But anyway, so I went to see my mom. My mom said, I need to see you. There's some things I need to tell you. And I had not found it necessary to throw those secrets in her face all of those years. And I drove up to where she lived, and she said, I was waiting for Grandma to be gone to tell you some things out of respect for her. And so what I had heard was that my mom and dad weren't married, that my mom had embezzled the money that my dad left me when he died. She used it to keep a roof over our head, but it was just how it was phrased. It was all like, oh, yeah, she embezzled it. Should have been mine. When I was 18, I should have had all this money and, you know, all this crazy stuff. But and that my dad was an alcoholic and a womanizer. So those were the secrets that I had been told. So I sit down with my mom, and she starts talking to me, and these are things she had not spoken out loud in over 30 years, not even with my grandma. Like, they both knew but didn't speak. And what that was is that at 8 years old, my grandma was sent to live with another family because her family couldn't take care of her and her sister. So she went to live in a house where she was physically and sexually abused by the men in that family, and she cooked and cleaned and was like the house girl, never went to another day of school. The way she got out of that is she got pregnant with my mom at 18 and married a man that she didn't love. By the time my mom was born, she had already left that guy and had gone off to her career, which my mom believed was nursing. My mom's dad got remarried and was running a home for children. But my mom was with my grandma, and she was left in boarding schools. My mom was involved in the Catholic Church, and she was left at the Catholic boarding schools. And my grandma would forget her over summers when all the other kids would get picked up. She'd leave her in movie theaters during the day. And finally, my mom went to live with her dad, and it was about that time that they made her choose between her mom or her dad. And she chose my grandma because my grandma would always show up in fancy cars and furs and shiny objects, you know, and that seemed to be the more glamorous. And so my mom ended up going with her. And it turned out that my grandma's real life was racketeering and prostitution. And so she had turned to this life of crime, and she was a madam at a place in Mojave. And so she was doing that, and my mom went to live with her, and she turned my mom out to work the family business when she was 15, and so my mom never went to another day of school. And at the age of 15 and in the age of 16, my mom had children that she put up for adoption, which is why she urged me so much to do what I did when I was 13, because she tried to keep that first baby, and it was really painful for her. And her experiences of love and of parenthood are all really horrible. And I got that she was trying to protect me. And then she went on to tell me about what her life was like as a child and what her life was like as an adult, and the sexual abuse and the physical abuse and the church turning her away because of who she had become, and my grandma kicking her out when she was pregnant both of those times because my grandma thought that my mom had seduced her husband or boyfriend and, you know, brought it on herself and needed to be punished. And so my mom lived on the streets of Hollywood, sleeping in doorways. And I've never heard a worse story inside or outside of Alcoholics Anonymous than the one my mom sat and told me. And she talked about after that, she didn't have any more children. She just terminated them. And at that time, you know, it wasn't legal. And there were a lot of horrible things that happened to her. And I'm telling you in a general way, although it does sound very specific, but there was so much more, but you get the gist. And my mom and dad were never married. My mom was my dad's mistress, which made sense why the money came. I got money when he died, but the wife's money went to my dad's wife. And my dad had, with his wife, had had an affair with a neighbor, so I found out I had another kid, another sister, who didn't know that my dad was their dad. I mean, so it was just like secret after secret after secret. And I'm so glad that I didn't hear this when I was 2 weeks sober. I don't think I could have stayed sober. And I'm so glad I didn't hear it when I would have made it about me, because it was not about me. And I got to listen to everything she had to say, and she was so filled with shame. And the thought of anyone else knowing this, she would have gone to the grave. But because I'd been making those weekly calls, because I'd been sending the cards, it had built this safety net around us, you know, and I was a safe person for her to talk to. And I said, I'm so sorry that happened to you. That's so horrible. And I was so grateful that I'd been given that direction to send the cards, make the calls, treat my mom like she was this superhero, because she was. She's like the greatest mom ever. I just was looking at it through my, you know, my experience. And I look at my grandma's life and my mom's life, and the life I had is the life of a princess compared to what they had. And I thought that my mom withheld this from me, love and direction. I thought she withheld it from me because she didn't think I was worthy. And I found out she never had it to give. And I spent my whole life being mad at her for not giving me something she didn't even have in her possession. And what freedom there was in losing that. And just like, wow, you know, and I got to just love my mom. And I'd already learned to take my mommy stuff to my sponsor and to my girlfriends. And so I got to just get to know her. And she was so funny and so smart and so damaged. Where I turned to alcohol, she turned to hoarding. Her house was like crazy hoarder on TV bad. And I would have to save all my pennies to go see her because I'd have to get a motel room because I couldn't even stay at her house. And I wanted to fix her and I wanted to change her. And at one point I wanted to report her. And Marilyn suggested that I not dictate how someone else live and that I just love her exactly where she is and know that she has a higher power and that I can offer to help. And that's as far as it goes. And so I got to just love my mom exactly where she was. And several years later, she got very sick. She had heart surgery and carotid artery surgery and lung surgery all back to back. It was several months of her almost dying. And when she recovered from all of that, I had about a year and a half with her that was, she was in great health. And we had just like this really great time. And I had been a good daughter all that time, but this was like, it was just different. And I feel like I was given this extra chance. And but then the lung cancer came back, and it went to her bones, and then it went to her brain. And I was able to spend the last, I usually don't cry when I talk about her. I just miss her sometimes. So, probably Mother's Day tomorrow, whatever. So she's 75 years old. She's got bone cancer, brain cancer, and we were going to the hospital for yet another test of some sort. And the x-ray technician comes out, and my mom just looks terrible and just looks at him and says, "This won't affect my ability to bear children, will it?" And it just made me laugh. And I thought, I would have missed all of this if I followed the well-meaning suggestions of therapists and my friends who talked about confronting and not keeping secrets and setting boundaries, you know, and all these aggressive stances, when in AA I was just taught about love and tolerance. Be kind and loving, keep your side of the street clean, boom. And as a result, I got to get to know this woman and love her. I thought I would die when she died. She's my only living relative, well, that I'm acquainted with, although later I ended up acquainting with my my dad's son, which is a just kind of happening now, so more on that later. But and I had been married one more time and got divorced one more time, and I was having a really hard time. I was not there when my mom died. I was in the town, but I wasn't there holding her hand. And I think, you know, sometimes we feel sad about missing that or whatever, but I think if we're meant to be there, we are. And I guess I wasn't meant to be. But I went through a really dark time the next few years of my sobriety. And I really didn't think it was because of that. It was several things. I had, while really depressed and in a lot of pain, and I had a resentment against my home group, I thought, this is a perfect time to choose a life mate. And I ended up marrying somebody I shouldn't have been on a second date with. And not his fault. Again, very nice person. We were just not compatible. And so I was in this unhappy marriage. My mom had died, and I wasn't working at the time, and my life got really small because when I was in pain, I wouldn't go to meetings. And Marilyn would say things like, well, when you stay home, are you still in pain? And I would say, yes. And she would say, well, then why don't you come to the meeting and be in pain? And I would be like, oh, you don't understand. You don't care. You're so mean. But it's true. You know, at least at a meeting, I can take care of my spiritual condition. And somehow I'm not thinking about my pain. The more I think about my pain, the bigger my pain becomes. But I realized something like 2 years had gone by of me being horribly depressed. I would go out on speaking dates and I would cry all the way to the meeting, wipe my eyes, go in, give a talk, drive home. And I remember telling Marilyn, I feel like a fraud. And she said, no, you're walking through this. You're showing up for your commitments. And that's the example is that, because I would tell the truth. I would talk about what I was doing about it. I wouldn't just dump, but I would say, you know, I'm going through a difficult period or whatever. And I remember exactly where I was standing in my house. I call it the lonely mansion with a tear in every room. It was at a time in my life when I had money. I was in a big house. I could do anything, and I've never been so miserable. And I was looking out the window, and I thought, I can't kill myself, because I think if you kill yourself, you have to come back and repeat all the lessons of this life. And I'm like, I'm halfway done. No way. Not doing that again. And I couldn't drink, so how do I best want to pass the rest of my wretched time on this hateful planet? And I thought maybe I could help someone else. And that's what I started doing. I started volunteering on a regular basis at the Midnight Mission, which is where I now work. I got a full-time job there as a result of being there as a regular volunteer. I'd started volunteering when I first got sober just on holidays, but now I was volunteering several times a week. And in doing that, I started crawling out of that hole, and I went through the steps again with my sponsor, and I increased my meeting schedule, even though I didn't think, this is not about that. I'm sober. This isn't the problem. It's always the answer. Go to meetings, work with a sponsor, work with new people, read the book, you know, all that stuff. If I just do that, I can tap back into that joy or that pink cloud anytime. I'm tapped in right now because I'm doing all that stuff. And so that was a huge part. And the Midnight Mission, next to getting sober, is the greatest thing that's ever happened to me. I get to take all the love and hope I get in these rooms, and I get to take that to Skid Row every day to the people who have had all the yets happen. You know, we say, well, this hasn't happened to me, and you go, yet. They've had all the yets, you know. And I have always found singing really cathartic. Music has been a huge part of my life. Not so much for my audiences, though, as it turns out. And this was a really big thing for me. I thought, how could God give me this desire and this passion and then have me suck at it? And I thought it was cruel. And it's not that I haven't tried. I've taken classes. I've done musical theater. I've been in bands. But I have to, it's just, yeah. Anyway. So I just thought, this isn't fair. And what happened for me is when I started working at the Midnight Mission, I started a music program. And I am now a conduit to that music. I bring in musicians to play for our homeless community. So I'm involved in music all the time. I still play for fun and for free. You get what you pay for. With a friend of mine. But, you know, I realize that maybe God gives us those desires and those passions, not for us to shine, but maybe for him to shine through us. You know, for me to use that desire and that passion to help other people. And maybe that's why it's there. Maybe it's not for me to be the best singer on the planet, but to my passion carried this program, and now it's this thriving program. And so many things like that have happened in my life. And my relationships are different today. Thank God, right? So what happened is, as I went through that horrible depression and crawled out of that hole, for the first time in my life, I was complete. Now, I had always loved the notion of you complete me. Ugh. You know, that's so like, Jerry Maguire, God. Anyway, But what that means is without you, I'm incomplete. And now you're responsible for my happiness. And you're not going to be able to make me happy. I'm going to have to overlap you. And neither one of us are going to end up happy. So what I've come to find out is that before I get into a relationship, I have to be complete. And then the people in my life enhance my life. And so I had gone through that divorce, and I was doing really great, working at the Midnight Mission. I felt happier than I'd ever been in my life. And that was in 2010, and I fell in love. I fell in love with a normie who we did everything differently than I've ever done anything, like no U-Haul on the second date. And we dated slowly. We got to know each other. I knew his friends. I knew his family. We didn't move in together until we were together 3.5 years. We got engaged shortly thereafter. And our life was so sweet that I felt embarrassed telling people, because I felt like they, you know, people would be complaining about their, you know, girls I sponsor, or people about their marriages and their relationships. I'm like, that's not what mine's like, you know. We would go to bed at night watching TV or listening to music, or sometimes we'd read, which is just so sweet, and holding hands, laughing, and then we'd wake up and have coffee together. He didn't have to, because he would go to work later than me, but he'd get up, and while I was taking a shower, he'd be making my lunch, and on each of my little bags, he'd write love notes, and then he'd walk me out to my car, get me into my car, and then we'd talk throughout the day. I mean, it was sickeningly sweet. And he worked for a radio station, and I did all of the events with him, and he let me use his celebrity to do all these events at the Midnight Mission, and it was just it was the fairy tale that I had always dreamed of, although I had this really weird feeling in my gut that wouldn't go away. And my sponsor said, I think you may be trying to sabotage this relationship because you have no proof. What is the proof, you know, of whatever that feeling is? And it turned out he ended up having this 20-year AA surprise party for me. I'm like, oh, maybe that was that feeling, you know? But the feeling didn't go away, and so one night I had to follow that feeling, and I found out that he had this whole secret life. And so my whole life is based on the idea that someone can change. In AA, the Midnight Mission, it's what I do 24/7, so I had to bring that home. And because of my recovery and because I was complete, I got that it wasn't about me. It was not personal. But he had been having relationships with many, 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 many people. And it was shocking. I mean, I still couldn't believe it, because to my face, it was still. So anyway, I got that it was a thing, that it was his thing. And so I was willing to get help and try and work it out. And so that's what I did until I couldn't anymore. And so that's where I stand today, and I'm telling you this because he is moving out as we speak, and I said goodbye to him before I got on the plane today, and he'll be gone tomorrow when I get home. And I want you to know, though, so I am completely heartbroken, and I have never, never had this kind of betrayal in my life, drinking or sober, but I feel more complete than I ever have. Because I am so tapped into this program. I had a sponsee meeting at my house last month, and I left the room for a minute, and I came back, and a few of my sponsees were in the kitchen, and they were tittering and laughing, talking about me the way I talk about Marilyn, who I love, and I'm just like, I love Marilyn so much, you know? And I heard them talking about me, and I said, ah, that's it right there, you know? I'm sad and all of that, but I am totally complete as a result of this program. And I have, you know, this incredible fellowship. You know, I have no family, to speak of, nobody required by blood or law to love me, but I have a huge village of people. And I was living on this, and I'll end with this, but, I was living on this idea that I am nobody's number one. You know, like, my sponsor loves me, but she's got a husband, she's got kids. I have a best friend, but she's got a son. You know, everybody has somebody who is their number one. I'm nobody's number one. And so I was just so sad about that, and I was nursing that. But then it occurred to me, just like a couple of months ago, That in what situation would Marilyn ever be given the choice, you must choose between your child and Georgia right now? Nobody's ever going to be given that choice. This is like one of those old ideas that I've just been nursing that's kept me in unhealthy attachments. But everything that's good in my life is as a result of Alcoholics Anonymous. It has given me a life beyond my wildest dreams. I am hopeful about the future, and I am filled with joy with a side order of a broken heart. Thank you for listening.
Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoyed the podcast. Sobercast is ad-free, and we'd like your help in order to keep it that way. So if you'd like to help us be self-supporting by pledging $1 or $2 a month, visit Sobercast.com and look for the donate links. Thank you very much.